Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of The Grape Nation is brought to you by Vivino. Discover and buy wines wherever you are. Visit vivino.com/heritage to stock up.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Raj Vaidya. We'll talk to Raj about fine wine, fine dining, big anniversary coming up, and a lot more. We'll taste the Beaujolais for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Raj Vaidya grew up in a family obsessed with food and wine in Bombay, Singapore, and of all places, New Jersey. Raj cut his teeth in New Jersey, going from bacon bagels to pouring the finest Burgundies. He went on to work at some of the best restaurants in the country, including Crew, Per Se, Gary Danko, and Seeger's, while receiving his advanced certificate and diploma in wine. Raj is the head sommelier for Daniel Boulud's eponymous Daniel restaurant in New York City and oversees the wine program for the Dinex group, which is Daniel's restaurant group. Over at Daniel, he oversees four somms and a massive wine list at this legendary restaurant, which will be celebrating its 25th anniversary. Welcome to the show, Raj.
Thanks for having me.
Did I get that intro right?
That was pretty good.
All those places. All right, so let's talk about that. So let's not assume everybody knows everything about you. So I want you, because you have an interesting past, I want you to give us a quick background, because sure. I think it requires time, but we don't want to take the whole show up.
Naturally.
About your journey in life and wine that got you ultimately to where you are, which is the Daniel Dinex Group.
Sure. Well, as you touched on, my family really loves food, and all of my memories, and I really only understood this in retrospect, all of my fondest memories about time with my family and growing up often had some food component to it. You know, we would go to a new city. My parents loved to travel, so we got to see quite a bit of the world. And everything was decided upon on the basis of one anchor, which was where are we having dinner or where are we having lunch, you know? And that informed me and informed my choices as I sort of made my way through life. I started working in restaurants when I came to the States. I was actually born in the States, but grew up in Asia. And
when did you move states?
I went to India when I was a toddler.
Okay.
Yeah. Arguably was born here for the purpose of the American passport.
Okay.
My parents were living in the States at the time, but had intended to move back. And when I got back, I was a teenager, and I didn't have a driver's license. The concept of driving a car if you're a kid growing up in India or Singapore is very far removed.
Not like the States.
It's a scary place to drive. even today, I'm not sure.
I'm sure.
Driving in Bombay. So you tried to find employment when you arrive in the U.S. So that you can pay for your women fancy. And the only thing that I could find was either the pizzeria down the street or the bagel shop further down the street. I was ambitious, so I went to the bagel shop. Also, it seemed kind of like fun hours. It was bizarre. I would start working at 3 early. In the morning, you know, work with this odd Polish man who never had a cigarette not
dangling
out of his mouth, as his arms were inside this 900-plus degree oven. Anyway, working in restaurants started from there, and I ended up in the wine business somewhat backwards, found an interest in wine, a love for wine, actually left the restaurant business after I graduated college briefly, but realized that the path I'd chosen wasn't for me. So when I went back to the restaurant that I'd been working in, I said, can I have my old job back while I figure out my life? And my boss more or less said, well, I don't have your old job, but I need a sommelier. I said, well, I don't know that much about wine, so I'd love to learn about this. I'm up to the challenge. What do you think? He said, well, you better figure it out. Here are the keys.
Wow.
All the best. So I spent a big part of the early part of my career, and actually much of it, backpedaling out of pretense.
Right.
You know, right. I spoke to a group of sommeliers a couple of years ago and tried to explain that, and had maybe 35 people walk up to me afterwards and thank me for having said what they've thought for so right. much of their career.
Too many people experience it.
The notion of expertise in a field as complex as wine is pure and utter nonsense. But that's what it takes. And so I faked it until I made it.
Clear up two things for me. When you came back to the States, family was...
We were together in
New
Jersey.
You all came back together?
My sister was at Rutgers
already,
and she'd come ahead while we were still living in Singapore. So we ended up here collectively.
And then you said, you know, you got into wine and you pursued it. But what was, you know, the family food thing was... But what was the time when you realized... You know, okay, I'm going to do this wine thing.
You know, I started paying attention to wine as a waiter.
Okay.
A lot of the restaurants I worked in when I was getting started had things like cinnamon toast and bottomless cups of coffee on the menu. Many had jukeboxes in the smoking section. So it wasn't exactly like wine was a big part of my early career at all.
Right.
In college, I started working in restaurants where, you know, the alcoholic beverage selection finally went beyond Bud Longnecks and you know, rum and cokes into what kind of rum would you like in your rum and coke?
Right.
It was baby steps along the way.
Brand names.
Yeah, for sure. Went to college in New Jersey. There's definitely, you know, in a small city, a lot of restaurants that had very boring, simple wine lists. I worked in an Ethiopian restaurant where clearly the Southern rep had written the wine list.
Right.
Everything either sounded African or actually was from Africa.
Right.
Or Chile for some reason. and then a couple more ambitious places that had some real wine on the wine list. And I quickly learned that if I could sound intelligent as I spoke about them, regardless of whether or not I knew what I was talking about, I would probably sell a more expensive bottle of wine, which would translate to my bottom line. And so I was motivated to do it.
Part of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a way a lot of people, my generation and prior, got into wine, is that it was a skill you needed. And
right.
I think you see that maybe less so with the emergence of sommeliers as being such an important part of the restaurant.
Right. So you said... You went back to one of the restaurants and the guy said, I don't have a sommelier. So really, that was the wine-centric beginning.
For sure. And
so that was a good restaurant in Jersey, too.
There's more to be said about that. I mean, it was a great...
All right,
take
me from there, you know, to present.
It was a great restaurant. It was a great restaurant that I started working in and originally worked in the garden. It was called the Ryland Inn. It had a...
Still there, right? Garden.
It is, but it's a different universe now.
Right.
The old previous owner doesn't have the place anymore. It's not as ambitious as it used to be. I don't know if they still have the garden. But there was a 5-acre organic garden where I started working for the summer. Working in trade, I didn't get paid, but I could take any vegetables I wanted. And I just found it interesting, the notion of farm to table in a real concise and clear way. The chefs used to come down to the garden every day to pick their herbs.
They were
service.
Early at that.
They were.
I mean, Thomas Keller was doing it.
Thomas
across the street with a small plot. Now he has like...
Thomas got his garden, I would have to say, if it had to be dated, much, much later, because Craig Shelton started this project.
Right. Craig was pretty...
In the 90s, well before Thomas had even bought the laundry. So this was definitely one of the pioneers, although it's long since forgotten if it was ever known by a lot of people. And also the other thing that people don't know maybe much about that place is that it had an amazing wine cellar, and that Craig Shelton, the owner and chef, was a great, had a great palate and had a great love for wine. And so he taught me a great deal.
He was an early influence.
Huge. Yeah. And in fact, as I look back on my career, it wasn't until, what I'll call the modern day, that where I really found myself finding mentorship and direction from people in the wine business. Prior to that, I mostly learned from chefs, and that's the old generation too, to some degree. That's why it's important for me to continuously work for chefs who actually know, not just know about wine, but actually care about wine. And I'm lucky to do so today. Well, anyway, so the Ryland Inn was a great restaurant, had a great list. I started taking over the wine program there at a moment which was inopportune for the restaurant, and business was very much down, a combination of the slightly delayed post 9/11 downturn in business that affected that part of New Jersey, and also the legislation which curbed expenditure by pharmaceutical companies, which in the old days used to take doctors out and
they
wine and dine
them.
They couldn't do that anymore. And the Merck International Campus is right next to the restaurant. So that
Jersey's
was a big part
a pharmaceutical state.
It was a big part of our, our private dining business and our business in general. So the only positive thing about that was positive for me, and that was the fact that we didn't really have a budget to buy wine, but we had a shit ton of wine in the cellar. And so I got to work with a lot of stuff either by the glass or in the wine pairings that you wouldn't normally be able to pour. And that included me having experiences like opening, you know, bottles of quote-unquote off-vintage Aubryon to pour in a tasting menu, and learning about the development of an old wine from a cold vintage and how it changes in the bottle, in the decanter. I learned about German Riesling there and found a great love for it. You know, wines from the 60s and 70s that they had that were in amazing shape. And we would pour them with foie gras.
Perfect.
It was,
right?
it was lucky for the guests and and for me that I didn't know any better.
It's some pretty good exposure. So you leave Ryland after getting exposed to some good stuff in about 04.
Yep.
And it's pretty much off to the races as far as pretty good places.
For sure. But, you know, I spent some time traveling, actually. I worked for a winery in California briefly in hospitality, Robert Sinsky Vineyards.
One of the few biodynamic.
Yeah, certified biodynamic way back then, too. And great people. Very nice wines. And I also worked, as you said, at Gary Danko in San Francisco. California and I didn't vibe that well at that time. It just seemed like it wasn't working out.
Why'd you go out? You just thought the opportunity.
California dream is like a palpable thing for every idiot in New Jersey. It's like the notion that the other coast
more
is better.
More Jersey than even New York?
Even more so, yeah. It's not until you get there that you realize you can't swim in the Pacific.
And
you miss, you know, the Jersey Shore.
So you get the hell out of there.
Well, it was also just, it felt like an appropriate time. I owned a car. I had nothing better to do. I'd never really seen much of America, so I got to drive around. It was a great experience. I didn't love California at that juncture, so I decided to look around, and I ended up getting introduced through Craig Shelton, the chef I had worked for previously, to Gunter Seeger, kind of in a backwards way. And Gunter was in Atlanta at the time at his eponymous restaurant, and I ended up moving there. I took an interview with him. He offered to fly me out to have a conversation. I said, sure, I've never been to Atlanta. There's no way I'm going to move to Atlanta, but I'll check it out. And I ate in his restaurant, and I was so blown away that I decided to move there. I worked for him for a year before I moved back to New York. I worked for Thomas for a couple of years at Per Se. I worked at Crew, which was both a wonderful experience because of the people I met and the relationships that have grown out of that. But it was also somewhat ill-fated in that my first day was the day the Lehman Brothers crashed. And if there ever was a restaurant that was built for the Wall Street set pre-08, Crew was it.
That was it. The wine list. I mean, just describe, you know, the size of that wine list.
It was bonkers. I mean, two leather-bound volumes, over 4,000 selections on the list, but there must have been 10,000 wines.
Private collectors wines. Had turned their wines over.
In fact, it was all the collection of the owner of the restaurant. It was all one collection and an epic one. I learned a lot from that guy about how to buy wine, how to focus on producers, how to support producers and understand the give and take. Things like you don't just buy only the best vintages from small growers. You have to support them and build them up and recognize that there's a place for all of their wines on the list or find a use for it.
It's more about supporting the guy, not just getting trophy
wines.
It's
not a one-way street.
This good is thinking, right?
Especially with the small-time farmers. I mean, you know, I've spent quite a bit of time visiting Burgundy, which was a big focus of their list at Crew and certainly is at Danielle. And man, you know, they make so little wine. And you see the prices on some of these bottles here in New York. You go and visit the guy, you expect to see a Jaguar and, you know, a couple of fancy watches. And if he got another, you know, 50 euro, he'd probably go out, buy a nice new pair of short shorts and bring you back change.
Crazy.
They're pretty humble people. So
did you leave Crew, or did Crew close while you were there?
No, Crew was still open when I left. Again, the writing was on the wall and the restaurant was very busy. And so I had gotten word and wind, actually through Michel Couvreau, who I worked with at Crew, who's now head sommelier at Per Se for some years, wine director Per Se. He had heard through the grapevine, probably because he was approached for it, that Danielle was looking for a head sommelier for the flagship restaurant. And I thought that that seemed like a perfect fit and a perfect opportunity. So lucky me, it took a little bit of conversation over the next few months, but I ended up starting to work at Danielle in May of 2009. So
you're going on almost 10 years.
9 years this year, yeah.
And not intimidated by a program or a list like that, because Crew...
It was a tiny list compared to Crew.
Right? I mean, that's less crazy. Than half. So you were more than exposed, prepared, and ready.
Also, frankly, Crew was probably the most casual restaurant I'd worked in for almost 10 years at that point. So I was very excited about being in a more formal, fancy environment. Crew was a nice, posh restaurant, but, you know, it was downtown. It wasn't very formal in its service. And I had always spent time for many, many years working in that environment. And I really craved it. I preferred it. I like working in fancy restaurants.
I would say Danielle is the epitome of what the definition of fine dining is, right?
Danielle, the restaurant, I think, is very, very good at that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Danielle,
and
the person...
somewhat seamless.
Danielle, the person, is almost, while being such an elegant and refined human, he's also such a down-to-earth, like, you can feel the farm boy aspect of him very closely as you get to know him.
That trickles
down. And that
inspires
in a great way the sort of honesty and realness of that restaurant. And that really appealed to me.
So you get to Danielle 09, you're presently there. We'll get to Danielle because there's a lot to talk about. But while I have you here, I want to talk about a bunch of, you know, wine-related things and all that. I want to get your take. I'm curious, a guy like you that travels a lot, is exposed to, you know, one of the most prestigious lists. What is currently exciting you in the wine world today? And that falls under trends, regions, wine, winemakers. I know you have to think about Danielle, that market, that wine list, but I know you don't just think about that. There are other...
Absolutely.
So tell me, what's exciting you today?
Well, to be clear, we have so many different kinds of restaurants in our group, so I am lucky in that I don't only have to work with fancy...
Keep correcting me, because I keep saying just Danielle. So
That's okay. But that's a relatively new thing for me, and I'm really enjoying it, because there was certainly a period where I didn't get to work with new, exciting regions and things like that. I'm a bit of a bore when it comes to my love of new, exciting regions. I think they're new and exciting to some people, but they often end up showing as classics. I think there's been a huge resurgence in interest in the Mosel Valley of late, especially the dry wines of the Mosel Valley, which are becoming better in quality. And, I remember when this restaurant, which is to say Roberta's, right here, first opened, there was no Riesling to drink with the pizza, and the pizza was so good, and I was like, well, you gotta have Riesling.
Right.
Is like perfect, and today it has like one of the great
Amanda
lists,
was here, and now Hugh Crickmore, who
exactly.
You know, continued.
So there's been more interest, and I think that that's been a huge boon. And the Mosel Valley is an amazing place.
It's some
beautiful
favorite
places. I know,
pretty stereotypical.
It is stereotypical. Well, I'm old. What can I say?
You're not that old. I'm old.
Fair
You're
enough.
Not that, you know, thank you. Nice
well,
brush off.
Yeah, I know every sommelier says that they like Riesling, and the reason that they like Riesling is because it's the most accessible, and it's at the same time the most, breathtaking, or the easiest to pair with food. But for me, what I like most about the Mosel specifically, and I should say that, like, you know, everyone loves Riesling. I'm not a huge fan, and I don't drink very much of Austrian Riesling. I respect it. I know what quality is, and I think that there are some great wines there. But I literally at this point probably own two bottles of Austrian Riesling in my cellar. I own zero bottles of Grüner Veltliner. I have thousands of bottles of German Riesling.
Don't like it.
It's just not my bag. But the Mosel specifically is interesting. But
just mention some other reasons, like Nahe, and there are different regions. There's a handful. Full of famous.
The Mosel area is particularly special to me because of that high wire act of acidity and ripeness. And then ripeness used to mean sugar realistically, and it doesn't anymore. There are some producers I love from the Nahe, from the Rheinhessen, Rheingau, even. It's not like I have no interest in those wines.
But
for
the
sure.
Mosel is
but
the sweet spot.
But the Mosel is a special place for me. Another region I think is super interesting today. Which got more attention than it ever has, probably, is the Savoie, the Haute-Savoie. There's really interesting wines, both white and red, that are starting to get my attention. And, it's not an area that I paid a lot of attention to in the past either.
Savoie is in France?
Exactly.
North? Yeah.
It's actually eastern France.
Eastern.
So think of the foothills of the Alps and going up into the Alpine.
Right.
Interesting.
What type of grapes... You know, reds and whites?
I have a preference for the whites, let's say. And the appellations, for example, of Chignan is pretty interesting. There's a lot of diversity. And so you can't say that the whole region produces great wine because it's actually pretty big and quite varied. But the stuff that I'm tasting, I'm finding very interesting. I think that the most interesting place for like new expressions of wine that we've probably seen in the wine world in the last 10 years has got to be America and California specifically, because the world of California as a wine producing region at the quality level has changed so much.
Right.
And the conceptions of the regions and what they represent, what styles of wine should be made there, can be made there, in, you know, Santa Barbara area and also on the Sonoma coast, even further north in Mendocino, it's changed so much. And I think there's super interesting stuff going on.
You and I were invited to a little talk that Dan Petrowski organized about the future of Cabernet.
Totally.
And to your point, I think the reason he asked is California is changing so much to what you were saying that, you know, is the old heavy cabs, the Colts, you know, there's more restrained stuff. You know, what is the future of that? Because Dan and Steve Mathias and all those guys are planting all these crazy varietals, you know, and doing a great job.
Yeah, a guy like Dan is getting to be more well-known for his Italian white varieties than he is for Cabernet.
You know? So you throw California in there as an exciting
region. I find it very exciting. Yeah. Because anytime that there's a real critical thought being given by players who are making a difference in not only the quality level of the industry or the base quality level of the industry, but also in the conceptions of the market.
You know, right.
The market is looking for different things from California today than they were 10 years ago.
That's
and that suggests, you know, that something's actually happened. There's been a big change. John Bonnet wrote that book that had a huge influence, I think. But he wouldn't have anything to write about if the people weren't already doing it.
I agree with that. Let's go back to Mosel for a second. Give me a couple of recos. Wines, you know, think more available, quality maker.
One of my favorite,
not the cheapest, not the most expensive.
One of my favorite, the beauty of the Mosel is outside of, you know, three or four top producers, everything's dirt cheap. So it'll be pretty inexpensive in the big scheme of things. Some producers that I think are really special. Two that I focus on quite a bit and I like to drink their wines. Ulrich Stein, who's making very pure style of Riesling, really a bright person, a bright mind, not a young guy, but so open-minded and has produced some of the more beautiful expressions.
He makes a newer winery, relatively, or it's been around?
It's a very old winery.
Okay.
And Uli's probably... approaching his 70s, if he's not already 70. I forget how old he is exactly, but he has the energy of a kid. And the wine that I like quite a bit, especially on the more accessible in terms of quantity and also price, is called, I think, the Blue Slate. It's so delicious.
Blue Slate?
Yeah, just a touch of sugar.
That's the name of the wine. So if you went into a good, you know, Brooklyn wine store and said, do you have Blue Slate?
I think it's probably easier to find in Brooklyn than most places.
Yeah, well, Brooklyn's like ground zero for that type of stuff. Tell me, what about, can you do the same for me for Savoie?
Yeah, well, there's a producer known as Domaine des Ardoisières. That's the best pronunciation I can offer because I definitely can't spell it correctly.
I'll look it up. I'm going to guess A-R-D-O-I-E-S-E-S or something.
S-I-E-R-E-S.
Something or like maybe that. There's an R there.
That sounds
okay.
About right.
Okay.
I got turned on to these wines here in New York, and I was so impressed. Very saline, salty. They kind of play the fine line between an expression of like very pure Chablis or Chenin, when it has that slightly savory edge, but very pure at the same time. You really get this ocean water sort of sense to it.
So a good seafood, shellfish, totally. Perfect. You don't have to drink
Yeah, but it
musket.
Has enough texture for even richer dishes.
Right. Salmon or pork. Other fishes and all that. I'll post that. I was going to ask you, and I think you answered the question, you know, do the best worlds and the wines have to be the most expensive? And, you know, obviously Romani Conti, whatever. But there are delicious,
there's many delicious,
terrific
options,
wines.
Yeah.
And I think if we had to think a little more, Riesling falls in that category. Savoie.
Well, it's a sad truth about Riesling from the Mosel, if you really think about it. It is inexpensive, and that's kind of like a thing I can't help but mention in promoting it. But the reason it's inexpensive is kind of strange. It's they don't have a great place in the market, and so they're not in giant demand, and so they have this conception that they can only sell the wine for so many euros a bottle. There's vineyards in the Mosel that were considered amongst the top 5 or top 10 in the 18th right. century that are not planted today. They've gone to shrub because there's no young people who want to work it. It's too hard to work. It's impossible to work with machinery. And at the end of the day, you work that hard and you can only sell your bottle of wine for, you know, 6 or 7 euro. So it's a little bizarre.
Is that marketing and organization and pushing up from the region? I mean, some places
sure,
do better than
I'm
others.
I'm sure it's a lot of that.
Yeah.
It's also some of the German sensibility.
They don't care.
Throwing more laws and new terms at it to try and fix the problem.
All right. So one last thing to that, wine's exciting you. So those two wines excite you. If you had to walk into, let's take Danielle because it's the biggest, most fancy. What's exciting there or different? I know there's Burgundies and there's Bordeaux and Daniels from the Rhone, and you probably have to have the appropriate amount of maybe some whatever else. But what's the wine there that is exciting or you brought in, or is there one?
Sure. I mean, well, I don't know how to answer that because I'm excited about all of the wines I put on the wine list.
But I know you're excited about the great Burgundies and Bordeaux, anything out of the
something off the beaten path.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what I'm asking.
It's far from being a nouveau region, no pun intended, but Beaujolais is a big part of that.
Good point.
I'm a giant
fan. It's having
fan.
Its time.
I drink a ton of Beaujolais. Beaujolais is very exciting to a lot of people right now. People are paying more attention to Beaujolais than they ever have before. Also, the prices of the land and the prices of the wines are going up. It's getting into better esteem.
Right.
You know, what you said earlier about in the world of wine, do the best wines have to be the most expensive? The answer is obviously no. However, I think that if great things become more expensive because they're great and they're in demand, then that's a good thing. Because as long as it, you know, flows in the right direction, the producers do better, can have a nicer life because they're producing something special. They make more people happy. You know, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree.
I have no problem with wine becoming expensive when it's really great.
Yeah, it deserves that.
For sure.
You know, kind of path.
Yeah, and then besides Beaujolais, I think on Danielle's list, it could be tough because, I love everything. But I think we do a pretty cool job with sort of those off regions of France or the back roads. A lot of stuff from the Roussillon that's inexpensive, right, but really delicious and pure, very stony.
So there's a perfect example of a classic restaurant with a classic list that will have some interesting wines. I mean,
totally.
Because of guys like you at the helm. All right, so those are all good ones. We're actually going to taste a Beaujolais towards the end of the show, and I want to get your take on it.
Looking forward to it.
Again, we'll talk about Danielle, the restaurant, and the group and all of that. But I just want to frame in the 10 years that you've been at Danielle and Dynex, what are some of the changes that you've seen, you know, in the world of wine.
In the world of wine,
yeah. Yeah, and I'm digging, women in wine, you know, has that changed? Natural wines are a big deal, which is less of a big deal, you know, maybe in your orb. But tell me, you know, you're going on 9-10 years. What are, if you had to look back at the changes?
Well, it's interesting to do that because it's only in retrospect that you see that there's gradations and you feel like one thing's a trend, then it becomes a movement, then right. Maybe it's still there 3 years later, right. Or maybe it's not, maybe it was a trend after all. I think that there's definitely been a big movement away from the cult wines of California. There's still a group that drink them, for sure, and it's not something that's disappeared from Restaurant Daniel, for sure. But in the world of wine, I see that having kind of dwindled a little bit of interest, right. And I think that California producers who are making
you're buying less.
I don't need to chase it. The prices have kind of gotten out of whack because right. They've continued to go up. And even as their direct-to-consumer business has grown so much for these top Napa Cabernets, they're taking more of the margin, so they're selling the wines to the restaurants for kind of high prices, so then I have to sell it for obscenely high prices.
Right.
And so there's very few that I still work with very closely. Colgan is certainly one of them, because I think the wines right. are excellent. They've gotten more expensive, but they're also really damn good, so I feel confident about that. But then at the same time, an interest in sort of an old style of California has emerged, and I quite like that. People come in interested in wines from the 70s and 80s before the
like
the
an craze. Old gravelly meadow
Diamond Creek's a
Diamond
big,
Creek
a big
or
favorite
something like
mine,
that, yeah.
Which you might have known before you asked that question.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I did, but yeah. That's a good example. Heights or something.
You know, Diamond Creek and Ridge are the wines I cut my teeth on early in the business. So I'm a huge fan, and those wines today are still inexpensive for the quality that they
right.
exhibit. Women in wine is an absurd notion as a trend. that sounds like a crazy idea, but I guess it's
are
not
women getting their due in the business now. New York is a little easier.
No, women are not getting their due in any business.
Job, salary, treatment. The
I
whole
had a
deal,
conversation
right?
with a young woman. I call her young, but she might very well be slightly older than me. But we're contemporaries, and she was in conversation about a position as a head sommelier with a group, and going back and forth in negotiation and. On one hand, I know that the person who had worked there before her, who was a man, was getting paid a lot more, and they were offering her much less.
Crazy.
On the other hand, I can also see that the restaurant...
She had the skills, though?
100%,
no doubt,
100%.
Right?
But on the flip side, it's like the restaurant's probably not doing that well, and they figured out they were overpaying that guy.
Right.
At what point is it, you know, completely even playing field? We're certainly not there yet.
See fair movement? I mean, good things towards
I think
I
think it's pretty slow, but yeah. My hopes are that it gets prodded along. Certainly, people are talking about things finally,
right.
For the first time in my career, really, or at least talking about things openly, honestly, and being interested in being part of the benefits and the change. But you know, it's a bit of a believe it when I see it. It's not very long ago. There's a kid who used to work for me who's like. Done pretty well for himself. He doesn't live in New York anymore, but he's got a nice following at his wine bar in the Midwest. And I remember I was hiring a woman to work alongside him. He was one of my sommeliers, was hiring her to be a sommelier. And his thought, he said, I hate to ask this, but like, can she break cases down? I was like, yeah, she can break cases down. She's a human being with muscle. She could probably kick your butt. This is only a few years ago.
Crazy.
It's bizarre, but it's...
Yeah.
Well, still very much in the dark ages.
A selfless promo. June is Women in Wine Month on the Grape Nation, and all our guests every week are prominent women in wine.
Fantastic.
Because we like to give them a voice and hear what's going on. One last thing about looking back, and then we're going to take a break. I want to talk about Danielle, and I want to do our wine list and taste some wine. But just give me a quick take on your take on natural wines.
Cool.
Personally, and I don't think it's an important thing at a restaurant or a group like yours.
We have a lot of natural wines on the wine list.
But are naturally there.
Right.
They're not there because they're natural. I mean,
and that's pretty much my take on it. I'm more interested in farming than I am in either sulfur marketing or philosophy. I think that farming is important. I think that clean farming, organic farming is important. I think that biodynamics seems to have a very positive effect on the vines and the wine that comes from it.
Right.
It could be because biodynamics makes better wine. It could be because the farmers have to spend so much more time in their vineyards in order to be effective at biodynamics. I'm not really sure.
Right.
But I have much more of an interest in that. I enjoy some wines with very low sulfur. I enjoy some wines with no sulfur. I have no hang-ups about wines with sulfur, sometimes a lot of sulfur. It doesn't bother me. Pierre Yves Collin makes some pretty some beautiful wines with a high amount of sulfur,
right,
and I thoroughly enjoy them.
Right.
I tasted some Prieuré Roque wines yesterday that have zero sulfur, and I thought they were fantastic.
Right.
So I'm not hung up on it. And I think that the genre or the movement towards natural wines is probably says more about our collective interest in what we're putting in our bodies than necessarily the philosophic bent of it. But obviously there is a very strong philosophic plan in place for some people who are involved in the movement. And that's the thing I'm probably the least interested in.
Right. Right. Like any movement, there's going to be people like
that. We have a lot of wines that are natural
right.
wines
some of
or fall in that category.
Some of the most famous wines in the world that farmers have been sustainable, natural, organic, you know, growers or whatever.
That we've, you know, championed on the wine lists
right.
in our restaurants. But the reason is because either the people make great wine or because the wines themselves are great
right.
for some reason or the other.
Steve Mathiasen was in last week and basically he said it's just as important in the farm, on the farm, as it is in the cellar.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a big advocate of that. All right, Raj, we're going to take a break. We're talking to Raj Vaidya. Raj heads up the wine program for the Dynex Group, Daniel Balud's restaurant group, and he's the head sommelier at Daniel's restaurant in New York City. When we come back, we're going to talk about Restaurant Daniel, their 25th anniversary. We're going to subject Raj to the wine list, and we're going to taste a little wine. So you're listening to The Grape Nation. We'll be right back. It's no secret that I like being the person who always has some great wines on hand. When I know I've got a few bottles hanging around the kitchen, I feel like I'm ready for anything. Even if anything is just because I never know when friends will drop by unannounced or because it's even a Monday. I also hate that last minute run to the store. Wine was never meant to be bought in a hurry. It's funny how we have so much patience growing the grapes, aging the wine, only to feel pressured when you're staring at the shelf. I use Vivino to scan and keep track of my favorites, but lately I've been stocking up through their web store. They have the best prices and largest online wine inventory, but can also give you personalized recommendations based on bottles you've liked in the past. And I use their premium service for unlimited free shipping. That's an extra bottle's worth of savings on every order. Plus, they have a 30-day free trial. I just grab a few at a time and save them for when the right moment rolls around. You never know when that'll be. Visit vivino.com/grape nation to stock up. All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Raj Vaidya from Daniel, Dynex, New York City. Raj heads up the wine program. Raj, I want to talk to you now about Restaurant Daniel and, you know, his group. But let's focus a little on Daniel.
Well, you know Daniel a little bit, right?
I know Daniel.
You got to chat with him a couple of years ago.
I interviewed him at Charleston. He is a very approachable, warm, nice guy. He took an interest in the show and me. He pulled me over and had some ideas for this show. I mean, not everyone does that. There was just something very kind of down to earth and nice about that. And I only have nice things to say. And we email from time to time.
That's cool.
So, you know, it's nice. And the nice thing is that his restaurant, where you spend a lot of time, is celebrating its 25th year. Which is a big effing deal for the category, you know, let alone New York, fine dining and all that.
A restaurant that's been in existence for 25 years in New York is a big deal. A restaurant that's been a serious success for that period of time is another story altogether. But I think that Daniel, the human, and the restaurant have become really an institution in New York. But it should be noted that the first time I met Danielle was in probably 2001 or 2002.
Before you interviewed?
Years before. Right. I went to the restaurant for dinner with my sister.
Mm.
My sister had a fancy enough job that she would take me out to fancy dinners in New York. We love food, as I mentioned earlier, as a family. Right. But my sister and I would be willing to spend more of her money, not my money,
right,
on fancy meals than our
job.
Parents. Yeah, she had a real job, exactly.
Right.
So we went to Danielle, and even the first time I met him, he came over and chatted. I was working at the Ryland Inn at the time, or maybe I just left, and he engaged so honestly and so truly that at the end of the interaction, there was no sense that it was contrived or fake in any way. He genuinely connected, and that's something that means a great deal to me, and it's so
not
true
common.
Of him. It's
right.
not common in this world in general. It's definitely not very common in the restaurant business, in the so-called hospitality industry. There's a lot of masks that are worn a lot of the time. There's a lot of pretense, and there's a lot of snootiness and sort of exclusionary activity. But Danielle, and I'm guilty of that probably a lot of the time too, but Danielle
is the opposite.
It trickles
down, and I'm sure you grab a little of what he's throwing out.
Absolutely. And it's an inspiration to work with the man every day, to be honest with you, because not only is he a real person, and not only does he really genuinely care not only about his staff, but about his customers, his guests, about his restaurants, but also about his family and the extension of all of that, the energy that he puts out there. He also is the chef who I think today amongst the great chefs, there's many people who are interested in wine, some who like specific wines, some who engage in wine in different ways. But there's no other chef in America, at least, that I'm aware of.
You've been around.
Who knows as much about wine as he does, loves wine as much as he does, and makes it a part of his life. And Danielle likes to tell the story of how, as a kid, you know, growing up in the farm just outside of Lyon, his job was to go down to the cellar and fill up the jug from the barrel of wine that was sitting down there. So it's
crazy.
Perfectly natural. It's been part of his culture, his life, since he was a little kid. I probably had my first glass of wine, you know, when I was like 18 years old.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure it was more correctly pronounced wan as opposed to wine.
Right.
It definitely came out of a jug.
Look where he came from. I mean, that was kind of ground zero for wine. What does he have a preference? I know he probably would love to taste everything, has tried
it.
But I mean, if he's pulling a bottle himself.
If Danielle's pulling a bottle himself and it's for a weeknight or a drinking festival, it will be Beaujolais.
It will be Beaujolais?
Beaujolais was the local wine when he was growing up, and he has a real love for it.
Never gave it up.
Why would you? I think it's better than it was when he was a kid, for sure.
Wow.
Or at least when he was a teenager, let's put it that way. But he also has a great love of the classic wines of Bordeaux. Chateau Aubryon is one of his favorites. He really loves Burgundy, and he loves the people of Burgundy, Volnay, the wines from D'Angerville. He often talks about them and thinks about them.
The Marquee.
And then the Northern Rhone, which is the other close neighbor to the homeland, and specifically the wines from Cornas and Hermitage, the wines of Chaves. He's a great lover of those.
Great stuff. So you do the wine buying at the restaurant. When you do that, you're like, all right, let me get a little more of this because he likes that, or that doesn't play into it.
Well,
let me have enough D'Angerville in the house because
I make sure we have enough D'Angerville in the house because we need enough D'Angerville. But if he ever needs a bottle of wine, he knows where to look.
So I think, you know, 25 years, the way you describe Danielle, I think all those aspects are the reason that the restaurant's been around, and, you know, the way he connects with staff, customers, his passion for the food.
It's a sense of generosity. That's really what it comes down to. He's a very generous person.
All right. So talk to me. Let's stay with Danielle, the restaurant. Talk to me, because it's a, you know, incredible wine program there. Talk to me about the wine program there.
Sure.
Program there. Talk to me about size.
So
impressive selection.
Yeah, we have a big cellar. I often like to show it to sommeliers who are working in New York because when you show it to people who are working in the Midwest somewhere, they come in, they're like, wow, it's a good amount of wine. But what they don't notice is what a giant space it is. But if you're a New Yorker, you come in there, you're like, you can't
it's
help
but
say,
for New York.
How many times the size of your apartment is the wine cellar is the usual conversation.
On premise?
On premise. We aren't using any offsite storage at the moment, but restaurant group wide, we have in the past. It's big, and that's helpful because we buy a lot of wine. We are able to buy Burgundy on release, which, you know, is vital because the quantities available are minute, and also because the prices tend to escalate quite quickly after that, and then age them for a few years before we put them on. So 2011s are starting to, the top wines from 2011 are on the wine list.
Coming
of Danielle,
to the table.
The 12s and 13s and 14s are in the cellar aging. We have the ability to buy big quantities of very nice wines from Bordeaux, for example, which is very important because we have a big Bordeaux list and a big Bordeaux-loving customer base. I have a preference for a classic style, so I tend to like the wines really 90s and back, or prior to the 90s, although obviously we have to have...
So those are vintage years, 90s and back. We talked about it off air a little. Those are better wines and better values than the same producers today. Talk about that.
I'm not going to say that they're better wines necessarily.
How did you say it?
However, what I would say is that if you were to buy Bordeaux on Premier today as a restaurant, you're either really, really cash rich or stupid.
Okay.
And the reason is simply that you can buy wines from the 70s. You can. I try. You can buy wine from the 70s and the 80s cheaper than you can buy current release Bordeaux. And it's very difficult to taste Bordeaux and know what you're getting once the bottles are finished, because if you go to the on-premier tastings, you're definitely tasting samples of some barrels. But these are productions sometimes of wines of hundreds of barrels, maybe even thousands of barrels. So what you're really getting in the bottle could be quite different than what you taste.
Right. What touches do you think you've put on the list since your tenure there?
Well, the big difference between my predecessor and myself was a focus on Burgundy, and it might have honestly been...
I focus more on Burgundy.
It could be said that it's because I love Burgundy, which I do, but it could also be as a matter of habit, which, coming from Cru, Burgundy was borderlining on religion. And so we've expanded the selection quite a bit.
No pushback from the clientele. Why is all this Burgundy here?
We were ahead of that trend. And Burgundy exploded. And when it did, at least for a little while, we had probably had the best list in town because I just kept buying everything and I had access to everything, and not everybody was buying wines like that. I mean, obviously the top blue chips, it's a different story, but even producers like Dangerville, where I had up until recently, I still have some 2010s in the cellar that we never put on the list. But today they're trading,
crazy,
exponentially higher than what we bought them for. It cost us money to age them that long, but we're able to get return on that investment because of having been ahead of the game a little bit.
Crazy.
That, and also I'd say, these fringe areas, the focus on Northern Rhone, which Jean-Luc Ledoux, who was the head sommelier, rest in peace indeed, many years back, definitely had brought a lot of those wines to the New York market for the first time. But there wasn't as much of a focus when I got there, and we've expanded that.
Right.
German Riesling, obviously, has become a thing. Luckily, it's still kind of a low investment point, so it's not too much cash getting tied up.
You can have it and not take a lot of crap for it.
We use it a lot in wine pairings because it's good with the food, but you have to do some convincing.
Right. All right, talk some Somm stuff with me. Do you do wine education with your staff? I mean, do you really need to sit down?
For sure. With my sommeliers directly, I used to do a little bit more hands-on, but now I've actually taken...
For the group?
For sure, for the group, and even for the service staff, we do trainings periodically. It's hard to find the time, but it's so important.
Do you have to? Do you want to?
We want to.
It's better if you do it?
It's always better if you do it. The more people know, the better. Like I said earlier, the reason I learned about wine is because it had a positive effect on my ability to serve people.
Right.
And that certainly continues to be true. Now, what I have picked up, and this was, I give credit where credit is due. I learned this from a great sommelier I've worked with a few times, John Slover, who runs the group, what is the name of the group? Carbone and the...
Oh, that's...
the pool and the grill.
Yeah, that's Mario Carbone, Rich Terisi, Jeff Zillet.
I forget the name of the group itself.
Yeah, something hospitality.
But he runs that program, or that whole group. And he told me when we were working together one time, when somebody asked me a question and I laid out all the information for them, he said, "That's a waste of your time. You have to teach them to fish." So nowadays, when my sommeliers ask me something about a wine that I put on the list that I haven't really given them a heads up about, my answer is, well, it's going to be very simple. You tell me about it tomorrow, and then we'll sell a bottle and you get to taste it. And I think that's the way I learned wine. Like I said, I learned from chefs who told me what I could and couldn't buy. But most of the time, I learned by reading and then tasting and, you know, sharing the bottles.
To the chef point, do you have to meet with the chef regularly? I mean, the list is the list, and the food is the food, so it's not like things are changing. It's not that fluid.
The menu changes constantly, but I've worked with these guys for 9 years, and I it's very... It's a very nice environment where I do get to taste food as much as I want, maybe dangerously to dangerous quantities.
Well, and, we're on radio, but Raj is skinny, so.
You know, it takes a little work.
Okay.
Let's just put it that way. But there's definitely ingredients, techniques, and presentations that come back or repeat over the years or evolve in a certain way. But having been able to have an open conversation with the chefs allows me to intuit a lot of the time what I need to do.
It's an important relationship for you.
You know, when we do events and wine dinners and things like that, the chefs, Jean-Francois Bruel, who's the head chef at Danielle, and Eddie Leroux, who's the chef de cuisine, along with Chef Danielle, who's really the driving force there, we sit together and sometimes we'll taste the wine, sometimes we can just talk about it, and we'll talk through a menu. Sometimes it takes hours because they throw out ideas and I'm just sitting there saying, No.
Really?
No artichokes. No asparagus. Right. No,
asparagus
no
is the worst.
Dill won't work.
Dill's hard too.
Those are when they're the obvious things. But if we're talking about very old wines from Bordeaux for a special wine dinner or something like that, it really has to be fine tuned. But that conversation is very important. And I'm lucky to work for a group and with a group of chefs who'll actually listen. And that comes from Danielle for sure. You know, I will often be found in the kitchen saying to Chef Jean-Francois, I need you to change this fish to a different thing. They're drinking something that it just makes no sense with. And they'll do it.
That's great. I want you to quickly answer this question, then I want to subject you to our wine list, and then we'll taste a little wine. So let's go back to Danielle, because that's sort of the perfect setup. It's a huge wine list. It's a very imposing place. I mean, the surroundings, the wine list. There are regulars, there are people who go ham, and then there are some people that go there once for
special
their anniversary.
Occasion, totally.
Yeah, you know, which is a big deal.
And it can be daunting.
It could be daunting. What do you tell that guy? And this goes to any restaurant, any wine list. How should the experience be the least intimidating for that person? What advice can you give to that guy?
The best advice I can give is truly to approach it without fear, because
what does that mean?
What that means is that the motivation or the reason for it being so intimidating is based in fear of looking like you don't know what you're talking about. As I stated earlier in this conversation, when I started learning about wine, I definitely didn't know anything I was talking about, but I kept talking and made it sound like I knew what I was talking about and everything was fine. There's a fear of looking like an idiot or looking like a cheapskate or looking like a mark to be taken advantage of. And the reason that I say approach it without fear is that the sommelier's job is not just to open a bottle of wine, put it on your table, put it on your check, and collect your money. The sommelier's job is to make the experience in a restaurant like this something really special. And we have that opportunity. I do the best I can to speak very frankly and openly and honestly with our guests who look like they're a little uncomfortable. There's no shame in any of it. I put all this wine on the wine list. I'm going to go out on Sunday to a pizzeria and probably drink like an $80 bottle of Chenin. It's okay. Don't be afraid of telling the staff, and especially the sommelier, what you like and what you want.
So communicate your likes.
Right. Absolutely. But approach it without trepidation. You know what you are actually in
don't
charge.
Don't BS. Here's exactly. what I
you're actually right. in charge.
Don't what tell you, them what you think they want
to
hear.
We're actually here to bring to you what it is that you want. The reason that you're here, and so you shouldn't have any trepidation about being very clear in stating what that is, how much you want to spend, what type of wine you like, what type of wines you don't like. If you don't know how to explicitly state that, if you feel uncomfortable with wine terminology, just tell us what specific wines they are, because very often we'll know one or two of them and we'll get an idea from that and be able to extrapolate into what you like. That's what we do.
So those handful of questions or statements from the consumer, it's important to convey.
For sure. And sommeliers will ask those questions. Any good sommelier will know to ask those questions, and don't feel intimidated by those questions either. It's really just a fishing expedition to make sure that we get you what you want.
Right. All right. So that's good advice. We got to wrap up soon, but I want you to buzz through my wine list. I'm going to ask you a handful of questions. You don't have to dwell on them. Curious, you know, what you're thinking and drinking. So what are you drinking now? Are you tasting anything specifically? Is there anything on your table at work or home? Are you boring and it's the same thing? What are you drinking right now?
I drink a good bit of champagne. Mostly like small grower champagnes. That's the bulk of what I drink at home.
Give
me my girlfriend love.
One or two things you're loving now.
I'm a big fan of the wines from Raphael Beresch.
Beresch, B-E-R-E-C-H-E.
Exactly. He's gotten a lot of attention of late, and I think the wines are really exceptional. And then Alex Charton in Chartonne Taillé.
Right.
His basic Cuvée Sainte-Anne, for how inexpensive it is, it's incredible.
So you're drinking champagne, you're drinking those two guys. Give me Raj V's favorite wine and food pairing.
Well, pizza and Riesling, naturally.
Pizza and Riesling, okay.
Von Schubert from the Ruwer Valley in the Mosel area.
All right.
And we pepperoni get pizza.
We get a lot of pizza and champagne, yeah. Which, you know, is
which
good
works
too,
really
but,
well too.
But
yeah.
Pizza and Riesling, that's a good one. Don't incriminate anybody, not backing you against the wall, but favorite wine restaurant and or a bar in New York, somebody that's doing it right, good list, good vibe.
Can I give you two?
Give me a bunch.
I'll give you a bunch. Cool. Well, my favorite place to go drink for drinking is Compagnie de Vins sur Naturel.
Okay, that comes up a lot. That's
Caleb's
great.
Made not just a wine list that's really
but
approachable,
vibe.
But a vibe. Yeah,
right.
And he made it the place to be.
I agree.
Caleb's a good friend. He worked with us, full disclosure, and so obviously I'm partial, but if it wasn't any good, I wouldn't go there. I have a lot of friends who have restaurants I don't go to. So
we did wine awards last year, and favorite wine bar and restaurant.
He's done it.
Compagnie.
And
that place, most guys like you came in, yeah, and mentioned him.
Well, and it's worth giving him the kudos, because when the place opened, it wasn't that great. Mm. And when he got on board, it was.
Right, you had another one?
Yeah. I think the best list in the city for Burgundy, the Rhone, Champagne has got to be the Modern. What Michael Engelman has done there, maybe 5-6 years ago when I had access to these two private cellars and I was just like pumping through the best old wine at the cheapest prices, I might have been better. But today I've got to say the Modern's list is killing it. And he is he's a force.
I agree. Full disclosure, I'm going there for dinner tomorrow night.
Except
I'll
hopefully you get
back
a discount now.
Whatever. I don't care. Happy to be there. Give me Raj's favorite all-time wine. It doesn't have to be the most expensive or the most famous, but what's like, you know, favorite?
Jerome Prévost La Closerie.
Wait, we got a ghost. Oh, Jerome Prévost.
That's a champagne producer.
Champagne.
He's based in the town of Gueux, which is
right.
A funny word to say.
Spell it.
G-U-E-X. Or maybe
okay.
It's E-U. It's hard to say.
I'll look it up.
But it's hard to say and to spell.
And Closerie.
La Closerie is the name of the estate and the single vineyard Le Béguin. I'm notorious in some circles in this town.
So Raj's favorite all-time wine is a champagne.
I would drink that every day.
Okay.
It's the only wine where I'll finish a bottle and very often want another bottle of the same. That says a lot.
That's a good sign. All right, last question, and I think you're capable of answering this. We ask our guests this. Best wine around $15-$20 retail. My kid's in his 20s. He's going to a dinner party. He doesn't want to bring a crap bottle. Can't spend a lot. Give me a red, give me a white. You can give me a region, a category, a producer. Start with a white.
Okay, well, a white is super easy because if you want to go 16 or under, the answer is definitely Muscadet. Muscadet is the best value in the wine world, period, probably.
Good food
but,
wine.
Even more so than German. And you get real wine for pennies on the dollar. For the
give
red,
me one or two makers.
I think Pepier is probably
Pepier.
The best. I don't know if Pepier fits in the $16 range, but
close.
Probably pretty close. And then there's a producer I work with at the restaurant, Manoir de la Ferretier.
Spell.
Which is fantastic. F-I-R-I-T-I-E-R-E.
Okay, that's
I
a good one.
I always pick the hardest to spell wine. So
yeah, why? Give me a red.
The red is a little tougher, I guess, but
it is tougher.
I would go
in
to
that
Beaujolais, and I'd go to Beaujolais Village, basic Beaujolais bottling from someone like
that's
LaPierre.
Not,
or
that's
Foyard.
Not crew, right?
Not a non-crew. The Beaujolais,
right? Like
collision,
the Galois Raison, or is that
that's a great one
from LaPierre, 16,
exactly.
18 bucks or
exactly.
Something. All right, so those are good recs. We'll post those. We got to get out of here in a few minutes, but Raj, before we leave, every week we taste a different wine on air for our weekly Daily Wine Sip this week, we're going to taste a 2016 Jean Folliard Morgon Côte du Puy. It's a Beaujolais from France. This wine retails for about, I think, $45. Not cheap, not expensive.
Yeah, it's one of the higher end, I'd say, because he's one of the four or five guys who demands the highest price.
What else can you tell me about it? So it's the higher end.
So Côte du Puy is a single vineyard. Folliard has a fair bit of acreage. I'm not exactly sure how much on the hill, and it's really picturesque and particular. You could see it from many different parts of Beaujolais. It's sort of a round top. There's one tree, solo tree, that sits on it next to a little hut.
It's like iconic.
But it is iconic. It's easily recognizable and has a few different exposures, south and east and even north. He does have some vines, I believe, facing north. Very classic in style. They're old vines that he makes this from, and it's one of the great, great sort of stalwarts and standbys. I buy this wine in virtually every vintage from my own cellar.
Good value for the price.
Totally.
As far as the quality.
You get great wine for $40.
All right, so let's give it a sniff and let's throw it over the tongue and let's evaluate it. First of all, color. Ruby, beautiful ruby color.
Sure.
Right, but kind of deep ruby. All right, give me your nose descriptors.
What I love about this wine is that even when it's super young, it already has a very distinct and clear mineral aspect. I'm not the kind of guy who talks very much about raspberries and strawberries, and so I don't really have much to say in that regard.
But you get
a real stoniness, like almost like a smoky stoniness, which is typical of Côte du Puy.
I agree. All right. Mouthfeel is sort of a medium. You know, it's not
you
thin.
You mean in terms of body? Yeah.
Yeah. It's not unctuous. It feels good in the mouth.
Right.
Give me your palate. Can you talk about fruits now, or you don't want to?
If I have to. I mean, there's definitely a presence of fruit. It's pretty juicy. It's got a lot of energy. It's quite a bit of pink granite in this vineyard, and that stoniness comes through. I don't know if I would identify it as granite, but it certainly has like a warm sort of stone character. Very long on the palate, too.
Nice palate. Nice finish. Give me some foods that pair well with this.
Coq au vin.
Coq au vin?
It seems like the right day for it, even though it's springtime.
All right, so not everyone's eating coq au vin. What's the second choice?
chicken, I think, in general. Chicken would be really
great
good.
Great chicken wine. Roasted, can hold up.
Roasted or braised, yeah.
All right, so we like this wine. We love this wine.
I love this wine.
Okay, I love this wine,
and I'm glad to taste it today because I bought probably 20 bottles of this.
I did the same.
Some are in France and some are in my storage, and I promised myself I wouldn't pull any more corks, so I haven't had it in a while.
I did the same, and I usually bring in cheaper wines. This is accessible, but accessible. I just wanted to taste it to see. I'm going to buy more, and I wanted to get your take on it. All right, Raj, we're going to wrap up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. I'm going to post Raj's wine list answers, and I'll also post the wine we just drank with a little more information. You can follow us on our social media sites. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby. And now you can follow hashtags. Please follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. And on Twitter, it's at BenRuby and the hashtag The Grape Nation. Raj, where can we find you and all the Danielle stuff online?
www.daniellenyc.com is the portal. If anyone wants to get in touch, you can go to Restaurant Danielle's website, which is that, and you can also access all the rest of our restaurants.
Okay. What about you? You post it all ever?
I have an Instagram account. Its primary function is to look at, you know, videos of kittens and puppies.
Okay.
But
like everyone else.
Raj Vine. R-A-J-V-I-N-E.
So that's at R-A-J-V-I-N-E. Yeah. Right. That's where you can find Raj if you just want to, you know, see what he's doing with kittens and all that.
I'm not doing anything with them. But
thank God.
I'm allergic, so.
All right. I want to thank our guest, Raj Vaidya, head sommelier at Restaurant Danielle and the Dynex Group. I want to thank our engineer, Vitor, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.